So I had mentioned yesterday, so I'm a chaplain at Providence, and for the microphone, I'm Susan Helver, and we're going to be talking tonight about culture. Tomorrow night, we're going to be talking about the LGBTQ community, and last night, we talked about caring for ourselves and for each other. And so as a chaplain at Providence, part of our practice at Providence is always to open with some kind of reflection. So I was looking through our red ELW book and didn't realize that In Christ There Is No East or West is an African-American spiritual. So I thought that was a nice thing to kind of ground us as we start our conversation tonight. So we will sing that. In Christ there is no east or west, in him no south or north, but one community of love throughout the whole wide earth. In Christ shall true hearts everywhere their high communion find. His service is the golden cord close binding humankind. Join hands, disciples of the faith, whatever your race may be. All children of the living God are surely kin to me. In Christ now meet both east and west, in him meet south and north. Oh, Christly souls are one in him throughout the whole wide earth. You know, it's interesting to me just to look at the words to that hymn and just think about, as an African-American spiritual, what it was like for people claiming kinship with all other Christians when all Christians are not always kind to each other and not always good at crossing barriers and boundaries. So as we talk about culture tonight, I wanted to just start with a little bit about why this is a passion for me. And different cultures have been a passion for a long time. I studied abroad. I was very lucky to get to study abroad a couple times in college, both in England and in Mexico and Central America. I've been really lucky to travel through Southeast Asia. I spent 2 years with Lutheran Volunteer Corps in Washington, D.C., working with homeless women in recovery from substance abuse in a post-treatment residential program. And that was everyone, both staff and women that I was working with there at Luther Place Memorial in Washington, D.C., were largely women of color, which was just a really powerful and growing experience for me. My nephew is African-American. And in the workplace, especially as I've been at the hospital, it's been a very multicultural place. And then as a Lutheran pastor, there was a recent study, probably about maybe 3 years ago, that showed that Lutherans are the whitest church across all denominations. Like, they're the only church that is more monocultural than Lutherans, I think, might be AME Zion, an African-American traditional church. But yeah, and that makes me really sad. I don't think that's what God's church is called to be. I think that we should look more like the kingdom and reign of God, which I think is a lot more colorful and diverse. So when I got to the hospital, I moved to Alaska in 2000 to take a call at a church and became a hospital chaplain in 2004. And what I discovered really quickly was that at the hospital, I would have a lot of nurses and other staff come to me saying, "Oh, Chaplain Susan, we're so glad you're here. What do we need to know about Hmong women when they're having babies? Or what do we need to know about the Sudanese when they're dying?" So they had lots of questions. And I had not realized how diverse a place Anchorage is. So in the last few years, we've had 107 languages spoken in our school district. It's at 100 right now, but a couple years ago it was 107. And it's, as I started looking into cultures, I found it was not a cultural mix I was used to. So any guesses at the top four languages that are spoken in the Anchorage School District?
English.
Besides English? But good guess.
Spanish.
Spanish is one.
Some native Alaskan.
So Yupik used to be in the top five. So I always used to say the top five languages, and Yupik was one of those five. I've seen conflicting numbers that place it in the top five and not in the top five. Samoan is one. So Spanish and Samoan are two of them. Russian is a good guess, but not one of the top five.
Somali
is in the top 10, but not the top five.
Well,
you're actually doing better sometimes than my... You guys have two already, and you're not living in Alaska. And when I asked this question, not in the top 10. So when I teach at New Employer Orientation, I ask them this, and it can take them a really long time. Okay, so you guys got... Samoan and Spanish, and then Yupik. So of the top five, Hmong is another one of the top four, and then Tagalog, which is the Filipino national language. But if you look at the top 10, which is just really interesting to me, so our top 10 are Spanish, Samoan, Hmong, Tagalog, Korean, Nuer, which is South Sudan, Yupik, Lao, Somali, and Russian. So if you were to look at the top 10 for the whole U.S., we only have four languages in common with the top 10 for the rest of the country, which the ones we have in common are Spanish, Tagalog, Korean, and Russian. The rest of the country does have Vietnamese, Chinese, Arabic, French, German, and Haitian Creole. So what I discovered pretty quickly when I started learning about cultures and thinking about how to work with the different staff and patients and families at the hospital, a lot of the resources for working with different cultures didn't fit where we were. Because mostly they look at African American and white and welcome, and white and Latino, and then Asian. And when they say Asian, they usually mean Japanese and Chinese. And that just didn't fit. It completely left out our Alaska Native population, which is a really large population. So I found myself having to kind of do a lot from scratch. Also, just to look culturally what our race and ethnicity looks like. I love using Anchorage school district numbers because I figure they're probably pretty close to what I see at the hospital. So 42% of our population is white in the Anchorage school district. So we know that for the country is moving towards a place of not having white people be the majority, but our school district is already there in Anchorage. 17% of our population is Asian, and that does include Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander. And I believe that Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander makes up about, I want to say 7 to 9%. Holly, does that sound about right, probably? Actually, it might even be 12%. Alaska Native and American Indian is 9% of our Anchorage School District population, so close to 10%. African American is only 5%. So we do have a significant African American population, but not the numbers that you would see other places. Hispanic is 11%, and then 16% of students identify as multiracial. And that didn't come as a surprise to me because as a children's hospital chaplain, I would frequently meet families and mom would be Yupik and dad would be African American or dad would be Filipino and mom would be Inupiat. So we have lots and lots of blended families. So multiracial is a really important category.
Yeah. I'm curious, are the doctors and nurses and other hospital staff pretty literate about working with these very diverse populations?
I'm going to say no.
About your learning curve. I'm wondering if you have a professional
with whom you... So, no, and that's one of the reasons that I offer this education at New Employee Orientation. So, yeah, so in the... I've been at Providence for 16 years now. My math's not good. And so pretty early on in the children's hospital, they started asking if I could do education for them just to talk about different cultures. And so I would do a lot on kind of what they might encounter for different cultures. But what I really wanted us to learn to do is become more culturally literate and just have the tools for any culture that we encounter. So we did that, and then a children's hospital bereavement committee that I was on sponsored a conference that was all about culture, where we had people talk about having good interpreter skills with different languages, talked about some of the more common cultures that we would encounter, talked about refugee culture, because we do have a large refugee population in Anchorage. And then finally, I was able to kind of eke my way into our standard new employee orientation. And so all of our new employees, they basically get about 30, 40 minutes with me, and then they get probably 10 minutes at their first day of new employee orientation, which is kind of just a really basic HR overview about different cultures. So they don't get very much. One of the other major hospitals in Alaska is Alaska Native Medical Center. They do a really, really thorough orientation to Alaska Native cultures, not to other cultures, but that is primarily what they see there. So I know they do at least a couple days totally about Alaska Native cultures. So yeah, so that's one of the challenges is we don't have as much cultural literacy as I think we really need to have.
I'm curious, it's great that you're doing all this, but I'm wondering how diversity and cultural sensitivity training became part of your portfolio as a chaplain.
Uh-huh. It's my passion. So, and I'd say that's kind of how I've always operated both as a pastor and as a chaplain, is when I see a need, then I try to learn more and teach and just help engage people in conversation. So, and it is part of the Association of Professional Chaplain kind of code of ethics and expectations is that we have good understandings about different cultures and be able to navigate that pretty well. So it does kind of fit in our wheelhouse. I'm not sure it should completely be in our wheelhouse, but no one else was doing it. So I kind of stepped
in. That's happened in jobs, I bet.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You see a need and you find out ways to meet it. So I also want to say just in the church, so being in the church in Alaska is also pretty interesting. Alaskan Lutheran churches, and I don't have numbers, we are a little more diverse than a lot of Lutheran churches in other places. And a lot of that is because we do have a strong Alaska Native Lutheran set of congregations. So Alaska's funny. I don't know if I talked about my hand model yesterday, but this is Alaska. South Central Alaska, where Anchorage is right in here. Southeast, Juneau, Sitka, Ketchikan goes down through here. The Aleutian Islands, Adak goes out there. Bethel and more of our Yupik population is, and sorry for those of you listening, you can't see my hand. So Bethel and the Yupik population are here, and then Nome, Inupiat population tends to be up towards the top. And so when Alaska, I want to say this was in the maybe 1950s, Sheldon Jackson, who I believe was Presbyterian, had it in with the governor and basically divided Alaska according to religions. So if you're around Nome, if you're from Brevig Mission or Shishmaref or Nome, I know that you are at least nominally Lutheran because that is the church that's in that community. Other places, because in most of our small Alaska Native villages, there is just one church. So you would be Russian Orthodox because that's the church that's there, or you're Catholic because that's the church that's there. And often regionally, you can have a pretty good idea what religion someone might be just because of what region they're from. So we have a pretty significant Alaska Native population in the Lutheran Church, but we're pretty split. There aren't a lot of really integrated churches. Probably one of the most integrated churches in Alaska is Alaska Native Lutheran Church in Anchorage, which doesn't just have a strong Alaska Native population, but my understanding is they've also got a lot of Samoans and people, again, that whole multiracial category comes out pretty strongly in that congregation. That's actually a congregation I'd like to visit some more. But one of the things that's made me sad in the Lutheran Church, so there's a few of us that are really passionate about this and have wanted to really engage conversation more. My pastor, Julia Seymour, and I were really interested in offering some kind of a teaching session just talking about how we talk with kids about race, which we'll talk a little bit about how we do that. This is a fantastic book. It's called Raising White Kids by Jennifer Harvey, and I'll talk about that some more, but I cannot recommend this highly enough. It's a really excellent book. And so we were at a gathering of pastors around Advent and just kind of asked around, was anybody interested in doing this? And basically from the white churches, the pastors were like, oh, well, this isn't really an issue for our congregation. And from the more diverse churches, they said, well, this isn't really an issue for our congregation. And I just thought it's kind of an issue for all of our congregations, but it's really hard for us to talk about it. So that's been another place of passion for me. So we did actually do a workshop in February on talking with families about race, in our families about race. That was pretty well attended. I think we had maybe 20 or 30 people that came, and it was a diverse group that came. I've done workshops at our synod gatherings related to privilege, and have actually I've been surprised at the number of people that have come wanting to engage in that conversation. So that's given me some hope. Our bishop is very passionate about this and has asked me to be thinking about what we can do for our pastors to do some more anti-racism training. But what I wanted to do is step back a bit, because I think one of the challenges with culture is that to really understand different cultures, we have to understand our own cultures first. And a lot of people who speak about culture will talk about how culture is like the air that we breathe or the water that we swim in. So how many of us woke up this morning thinking about the air that we were breathing? So we might have some, because here at Holden, the air is fantastic, and there's no smoke in it, and there's no smog in it. But a lot of the time, unless there's, like, smoke in the air, you don't really think about the air that you're breathing until it bumps up against something else, until you start having trouble with it. And so until we understand the cultures that we exist in, it can be really hard to recognize the cultural biases that we bring to any conversation or any relationship or interaction. So one of the things that I like to do at New Employee Orientation, and we'll do it here, is take a moment to think about a wedding that you've been at, either been in or attended or seen on television or in the movies, and think about the culture of that wedding. So think about, what did people wear? Where was it? And what I tell them at orientation is, I don't mean like it was in New Mexico. I want to know, was it in a church, or was it on a glacier, or was it on the beach or in a garden? Thinking about where those weddings are, thinking about what kind of food was there, what kind of music was there. And I'll tell you, it's really fun to do this at the hospital, because when I have the new employee orientation folks, there are usually a good 100 people in that room, 70 to 100 people, and they come from all cultures. I mean, this conversation I had about the top 10 cultures, all of those are always represented at new employee orientation. And it's interesting to me, because in that group, it's a super diverse group. When I go to our leadership council meetings or our safety huddle meetings with leaders, maybe on a good day, 10% of that room will be not white, will be people of color. So you can see the disparity there. And to me, that's one of the reasons we need to be having those conversations, because we're not integrated still. But it means I also get to hear really good stories about weddings. So just as you think about that, is there a wedding that comes to mind that stands out when you think about what would a culture of a wedding be? And for those who can hear us but not see us, we're a pretty white group here in this room.
My daughter's wedding was a very traditional American Lutheran wedding.
So I'm glad that you said that. Say a little more about what that looked like. What did they wear at your daughter's wedding?
Men were in tuxedos, I think. She had, traditional white dress.
Yeah.
Lutheran service.
Yeah.
Basically out of the service.
Yeah.
Her two nieces were flower girls. Reception was at the UW Faculty Clerks Alumni Club. Anyway, it was on campus. I don't remember the food particularly or the wedding, but the traditional wedding cakes.
Yeah. Yep.
I don't know. Two tiers, three tiers. Throwing the bouquet.
Yeah.
Bridesmaid.
So I'm glad you started us off with a traditional wedding, because that word always comes up when we're talking about weddings in our group. And the very first time I ever asked a group this question, one of the women raised her hands and said, well, everybody in our group had a traditional wedding. Only what they found was that as they talked about it, they had three very, very different weddings. So one of the women probably had a wedding a lot like your daughter, where they had the white gown and the tuxedos and maybe... No, so this is at the hospital. So I have
this hospital.
Yeah, this is the hospital. So one person had that kind of a wedding. Another woman, I think, was Filipino. And so she had a traditional Filipino wedding. So she didn't wear a white dress. It was probably a red dress and had traditional Filipino food. So traditional, but not the kind that you were thinking of when you said that word. And the woman who actually raised her hand is actually Quaker. So she had a traditional Quaker wedding. So the women wore bonnets and long dresses, and they had an hour of silence as part of the ceremony.
And that's why I phrased it.
Yeah.
As Lutheran.
Yep.
White American Lutheran.
Yeah. Well, and so I think, so I always like to highlight that, because I think often with culture, we often think that we're using the same words and that we understand what words mean, but sometimes we have to dig a little deeper or talk a little farther to find out if what we think we mean is actually what we're saying or what's being heard. Because that we often find a lot of cultural miscommunication because we think we're saying the same thing or we think we're understanding each other, and then you find out that not really quite so much. So one of the weddings that will probably always stand out for me, I officiated a wedding for two friends of mine, two women. One of them had been in the military, so the wedding was held on base. And they had kind of a carnival theme for their wedding. So they had the big bouncy house, and they had the sumo wrestling suits, and they wanted to say their vows over a dunk tank. And that was where I drew the... Okay, so I'm looking at my mother's face, and you can't see it, but she's wrinkling up her eyes. And that's kind of the expression I had when Catherine told me this is what they were going to do. And that was where, as a pastor, I kind of drew the line, and I said, I want you to be able to focus on each other when you say your vows, not worrying about whether you're about to fall into the water. But I'll tell you, the wedding ended up being really, really fun. It completely suited them. It fit their personalities. We did the ceremony, and after the ceremony, they broke out Nerf guns and had a Nerf gun fight, and everybody had a good time. You still can't see my mother's face. But so here's the thing. Again, I think with cultures, there are a lot of times that we'll hear somebody say something or talk about something that's important to them or talk about a food that they love, and our first reaction is, why would you do that? And so again, with culture, we often have to get past that first initial reaction because again, so what we just did was that wedding bumped up against my own values about what should happen in a wedding, and clearly also against my mother's values about what should be in a wedding. And we might not have known that we had those values until something bumped up against them. And yet, with so many cultural things, once you understand the people better or their history or their values, Holly and I have talked about how in Alaska, there are a lot of Alaska Native foods that people love, that they actually love feeding them to white people because they love watching our faces when we try muktuk whale blubber for the first time because it's not easy to eat. But again, if you live in a climate where that's a major food and a delicacy to have, it's fantastic to get a chance to eat that. So often with culture, we have to be willing to go deeper, to kind of move past that first reaction that we have, and to be able to get deeper and really understand where someone's coming from. And be, I think the biggest thing is to be respectfully curious about why people have the beliefs and passions and values that they do. And so we do this at New Employee Orientation, and what we talk about then is the culture that we all share at the hospital and talk about Western medical culture. And so we spend several minutes talking about what are some of the key characteristics about Western medical culture, because it is a very specific, distinct culture. So we know it's a very fast-paced culture. We know that in Western medical culture, we know that germs are really bad and germs can lead to disease. And we know the number one way to prevent diseases is through hand washing. And I've been giving people a hard time here at the Village because I love that they're very focused on hand washing, but I've learned at the hospital you should scrub your hands for a good 15 to 20 seconds. And we've also learned that actually hand sanitizer is better for killing germs than soap and water are, which seems sort of counterintuitive. But one of the things I'll show at the hospital, and I'll demonstrate here. So it's really common at the hospital, if you go to the bathroom, you do your thing, you go out, you hold your hands under the sink, and sometimes they're like the sinks in the dining hall where you don't have to touch anything. You scrub your hands for 10 or 15 seconds, and then when you're done, we usually have paper towels, not the blowers. And so you wave your hand in front of the paper towel dispenser. You get your paper towel. You haven't touched anything. If you have to turn off the water, you use that paper towel to turn off the water. You use the same paper towel to open the door. Then you use your foot to prop open the door and then throw the paper towel into the waste paper basket. And so I tell this at the hospital, and people are all laughing, but they're all looking at me and they're nodding, because in the hospital we have all done that little paper towel dance, because we know we have this culture that says germs are bad, germs spread disease, and we don't want to spread disease. But if I do that, if I were to do that here, people would probably look at me like I was a little crazy. Or if I were to do that at a restaurant in Anchorage, people would look at me like, what is she doing? Because we are not all immersed in this culture that says that germs could kill us. So there are a lot of things about Western medical culture that, for people from other cultures, don't make any sense at all. Our time orientation, the way we talk, the way we ask questions, who asks questions, the intimacy of the questions that we ask. So there's just a lot of stuff that, again, for us, it's really normal. And it's one of the gifts, I think, of being a chaplain that's been really helpful for me, is to realize that I can sometimes be a bridge for people, because I can often see what patients and families are not understanding at all and help do some interpreting so that we can kind of get the families and the doctors together and speaking more of the same language, because often we're not. And that's where we have safety issues happen. It's where care plans don't work out. So I'm grateful for the opportunities to do that. And so one thing I wondered as we're talking, if we were to think about the cultures of some of the churches that we've been in, or even the culture of Holden, how would you describe that culture? You know, and it's interesting because you were talking about traditional Lutheran culture, because we all, I think, have this gut sense of what it means, but it can be really hard to articulate because it's just normal for us, or probably traditional Episcopalian culture as well.
Well, I think some people wonder, you know, you talk about, well, it's hard to describe. I mean, it's a special, it's a really special place. And then I think some people think it's a cult. No, it's not a cult. But I mean, I think that just the opportunity to learn and to enjoy nature, and nobody's requiring you to do anything except come to Vespers at night, is a kind of a requirement. I'm not even sure that anymore is a real requirement. But I mean, and there were reasons for that, to check in and make sure everybody was, I got back from hikes and things like that. But I mean, it's a hard holding to me. It's a hard place to really describe until you get a chance to visit it.
Here's a story from our life. Eric and I met 20 years ago at a party, and Eric had a Holden Village t-shirt on, and I've been coming to the village since the late 80s, and it was a party. There were people that I didn't know except the guest of honor, but I saw that t-shirt and I said, there's someone I could talk to. So
yeah.
I think there were certain cultural assumptions, you might call it, that we had of each other, politically blue-green, environmentally aware, open to gays and lesbians, a male I could talk to about being a Christian without being looked at as if I was either a fundamentalist or stupid or a big bore. What would a fifth assumption be? Yeah, a place of intellectual inquiry. So those would, just looking
nature,
at the t-shirt.
Nature. Outdoor recreation.
Yeah. I mean, just by looking at that t-shirt, I made certain assumptions about this man.
Yeah.
And they were right in those regards.
I still have the t-shirt.
You might want to frame that t-shirt. Well, and I think about, so at our hospital, we do morning and evening prayer over the intercom, and one night I was working late and did the Holden prayer, go out with good courage. And the next day, I ran into a woman who was a labor and delivery nurse, and she said, did you do that prayer last night? That was the prayer from Holden Village. Do you know Holden Village? And she had been on winter staff a couple years earlier than that. So same thing. So like we were able to make that connection because she knew that prayer. She recognized that prayer and made assumptions that, okay, this was a chaplain that she could get behind and feel safe with and understand.
I would say another thing is, as an Episcopalian, I've been coming here for 30 years, and it's very definitely a Lutheran community, and very invested in its being Lutheran. That said, it's hospitable to those of us who are not Lutheran. You're never felt made to feel as if you don't belong here, or as if you're not welcome here, if you're not Lutheran.
So the things I wonder about, though, so we've been having some conversations about welcoming in my congregation that I attend. I'm not the pastor there, but I attend there. And so a young man and I facilitated some conversation about privilege and about culture. And it was some hard conversation for people. And I remember there was one woman, actually his mom, who said, well, I don't understand why people wouldn't feel welcome here. We've always felt welcome here. But that doesn't always translate. And when I hear stories from friends and acquaintances of mine who are African American, they tell stories about walking into a Lutheran church, and everyone asks them, so how long have you been Lutheran? Assuming that it must be recently if you're African American, when some of them have been Lutheran for generations. Having them walk into a church and have people assume, oh, you must be looking for the Baptist church. They're down the street. So stories like that, or even just thinking about things like, do we assume people are too loud or too boisterous? Or even things like kids. Is it okay for kids to be noisy and run around, or is that a bad thing? Do kids need to be quiet and sit still and pay attention? I see you nodding your head. But again, so I think sometimes we assume that we're welcoming, especially if I feel welcome, then it must be a welcoming place, right? And yet we may not see the things that we're doing that may not feel welcome. And I'll talk about this a little more tomorrow night when we talk about GLBTQ issues. But yeah, so I'll just hold, I have a story to tell about that. But yeah, so there are a variety of things that I think we do that, well, and then Juliet, my pastor, will talk a lot about, we are, Lutherans tend to be pretty highly educated. So there's kind of an assumption that you read and you're musically literate. And there are a lot of people, if you are more blue collar or not as literate, the Lutheran church might not be a super comfortable place for you to walk into. I mean, there are often some assumptions that may not be explicit, but are pretty implicit about what you can afford to do. I think things like that are really good to take a look at and think about. Think about who isn't in your congregation, who isn't at Holden this week, and why might they not be here? Why might they not feel comfortable? And certainly, probably no place is going to be welcome to everybody, but I think it's really important to think about the messages we may be sending that we may not know that we're sending. So I'm really lucky to work with a very diverse staff of chaplains. I have a couple African-American chaplains, a chaplain from Nigeria, one from India, one from Mexico, chaplains who are Catholic and Orthodox Christian and AME Zion and Old Catholic and Christian Universalist. So we have a variety of us. But I've talked with some of my African-American chaplains, and one of them told me that literally just about every time she would go see an African-American patient, the staff would say, oh, are you related to her? Every time. This wasn't just once. This happened again and again and again. I have my other chaplain said that, like, literally every day she has some kind of racism experience. One that she shared with me actually the day that she and I were talking about this. She said, yeah, I went to visit a man today and I walked into his room and he told me to get out of the room. He didn't want a Muslim chaplain visiting him. And she's not Muslim at all. And what I loved was that she hung in there and she was able to engage him in conversation and ask him, I don't even know what they did, but she was able to engage him in conversation. They actually had a good conversation, and by the end of the conversation, he's like, come on back anytime. And so I had her share this as a reflection at our staff meeting, because I thought it was, one, I want us to be aware. I want to know that that's happening to her. I don't want that to happen to her. And she's like, Susan, there's nothing you can do about that. That is just the world that I walk through. But I also want to make sure that my team is, that we're aware. I want us to know that we're all not getting treated the same way when we walk into rooms. And so she told this story, and another chaplain who's actually been visiting this patient more is like, oh, yeah, he still thinks you're a Muslim. Mm-hmm.
What?
He still thinks you're a Muslim. And yet, regardless, they were able to move through that conversation and get to a place of connecting and understanding. And one of the reasons she's going to be one of my strongest chaplains, she's a pretty new chaplain, but she has that ability to meet people and to bridge differences and to get to that place of having better understanding.
Well, I think that's a worldwide view, though. I mean, if you were in New Delhi visiting a white person in the hospital there, people would probably assume that you are related to them. Because
yeah. In New Delhi, yes. But it shouldn't be the assumption in Anchorage.
No, but my point yeah. being that I think that when you look at, you know, percentages of races, that might be an assumption.
Yeah. And so that's one of the, I'm just gonna watch our time, so we've got about 5 minutes left. So I think one of the challenges and one of the things I really try to instill in people when we're doing new employee orientation is to make sure that we're really working at not making those assumptions, because I think when it is when we make those assumptions that often we can be pretty off-putting. So one of the things we talk about is the difference between a generalization and a stereotype. So the example I'll give is if I'm in the hospital and I meet Rosa, and I know Rosa is from Mexico, and I assume, oh, Rosa's from Mexico, she must have a big family, because those Mexicans, they have big families. Well, I've just made an assumption. It might be true, but it might not be true. And I've basically kind of stopped what I understand about Rosa. If instead I can think, so Rosa's from Mexico. I've known a lot of Mexicans that have had large families. I wonder if Rosa might have a big family. If I can let that be a starting place for my curiosity, there's a lot better chance I'm going to learn more about her. We're going to be able to understand each other better. And the thing is, I mean, our brains work in ways that we do put things in categories. And sometimes that serves us really well, but sometimes it doesn't. And I think when our goal is to be welcoming, or in the hospital, if our goal is to find a plan of care for you that's going to help you heal and recover and in a holistic way feel physically, emotionally, spiritually better, then I've got to listen to who you are and what's important to you. And so another thing that we'll talk about, so we could have two women that are both Hmong, that are both 26, that are both having a baby at term, and they could have completely different experiences about their culture. And it might be that one of them was born in Minneapolis and has lived there most of her life and has been in Alaska for 10 years, and the other one might have come to Alaska from a Thai refugee camp 6 months ago. Those two women would both be Hmong in the same age and the same diagnosis, but have very different experiences of their culture. If one of them is married to a white American or to an African American or to a Yupik person, they're going to have a very different family life and experience of culture. Education can have a huge difference. How long someone's been in a country, whether you're first generation or second generation or third generation, whether you're from an urban place or a rural place, all of those things can have a massive impact on how people experience their culture. And so the more we can be curious and have cultural humility, and I think that's one of the newest kind of buzzwords, but I think it's a good one. I think the more we can really have cultural humility and be curious about people. Again, I mean, I haven't known a lot of African-American Lutherans, but I'm learning from the people that I do know that some of the Latino Lutherans that I know, their families have been Lutheran for generations. And just because that's not what I see in my church doesn't mean that it's not true. And so just to be able to have that curiosity, I think, becomes really important.
I wonder if as Christians we need to be more sensitive to the fact that a lot of us grew up in Sunday school and in church and know these biblical stories and Bible references, and increasingly, you know, a larger percentage of the population has no clue what we're talking about.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And, you know, I find myself sometimes making some biblical reference that's appropriate, just as kind of a metaphor for something that's going on, and people cock their head and look at me funny. That's a frame of reference that an increasingly large share of the population does not share.
Yeah. Well, and I see that when I visit other churches, like the number of times pastors will assume, well, we all know this story. We might not all know this story. Or even when we pray, when we say we pray for those people who are homeless and hungry, well, those people who are homeless and hungry might be us. But we've now made them other. We've made them not us, these other people that we're going to pray for. So just our language. And I will tell you, I have a lot of non-churched friends. And I have often, there have been times when they've been open to coming to church with me, come to church. They hang on to every word of that service. They pay attention to everything that is said, every word of every hymn, because they're not sure they're safe, usually, in the church. And it's unfamiliar. Whereas I think often, I know for me as a Lutheran, these are just words that we say like all the time, and so I don't even often hear what we're saying. But I took a friend to a Easter Vigil service, and she had been baptized, I want to say even Lutheran, actually, as a child. And as an adult, had renounced her baptism because she just felt that was not who she was. Well, they did a remembrance of baptism in the service, and she was so upset because she felt like we had just rebaptized her against her will. And she was paying attention to every single... I have learned since then that the Easter Vigil is not a good starter service for unchurched people, which makes me sad because it is my favorite service.
Yeah, but... friends responded to creeds.
Yeah, well, and so I love my pastor. Well, you got upset when we didn't use the creed. But you were raised Catholic. So one of the things I love about my pastor is that just about every time we do the creed, she will talk about how the creed is something that was developed, I don't know, I mean, I think of it, it's something that was developed to help bring the church together and find common ways that we believe, and we all say it together, sometimes believing on behalf of each other, because there may be things that each of us struggle with in the creed. When I talk about the creed, I talk about it being something that unites us across generations and across countries and across the ages. But I always try to introduce it with some explanation, because, yeah, for a lot of people, the creed is a really tough
thing. Those words
thing.
Have face value.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I'm just going to say a couple more things because I think we're going to get kicked out for Vespers shortly. So I mentioned this book earlier, Raising White Kids by Jennifer Harvey. So there are a lot of really helpful things that she talks about, because one of the things we find, especially with kids, is that it is very scary to talk about race and culture. And people's kind of gut reaction is, well, we shouldn't talk about that. And she actually opens with a story. She talks about how when she, the author, was maybe 6 or 7 years old, she was at recess, and another white girl, she's white, another white girl came up to her and said, we should start a club for white girls. And she looked at her thinking, what? And she said, yeah, we're the only six white, there's only six of us in the class, so we should have a club for white girls. And so the teacher came over and was like, you guys stop that. Don't talk. You shouldn't be talking about that. And just like basically came down on them. And so she talks about the lesson she learned from that. The thing is that what they were doing was actually completely developmentally appropriate. That was their way of kind of figuring out who they were and how they fit in. I think often for that kind of conversation as adults, we want to be like, oh, that's not okay to want to do that. And so it gives this message that talking about it is bad. Talking about what makes us different is bad. Talking about what makes you different is bad. And so we create this culture where kids and adults, we pick up messages really quickly about what's okay to talk about, what's comfortable, what's not comfortable. And so the point that she makes in this book a lot is that we really need to kind of normalize talking about culture, talking about race, being able to have a non-anxious conversation about the things that make us different. Because we need, if we're going to equip kids to be able to have some thinking skills about how they're going to address race and what does it mean to be white, what does it mean to be black, what does it mean to be Latino, that we need to, you aren't just born with those skills. And we all pick up things from the media, from the things that other adults tell us, from the things we learn in our families. So she really, really pushes normalizing those conversations and just having those conversations on a regular basis. And she has lots of really beautiful examples of ways you might do that. And she gives lots of scenarios of like, well, you know, here's something that happened. And if I'd been there, you know, how might have I addressed this with my child? What might have I said to my child? So I really appreciate that. She also talks about, we often think, well, I don't see color. I'm colorblind. She talks a lot about why that's not actually a helpful response. I mean, it would seem like it would. It would seem like that's welcoming all people. But if you don't see color, then you're not seeing the different ways that people may be impacted because of the color that they are or the background that they have. So not seeing color means there's a lot of stuff we're not seeing that's really important for us to see. I would be happy to talk more about this book with people later as well. And then just the importance for those of us who are white to make sure that we're doing our own work, because there's a lot of information out there, so not to rely on our friends who are people of color to do the work for us or to educate us, but to really make sure that we are engaging and learning where we can and doing work ourselves. And that also, as white people, there are important times when we do need to challenge conversations that are racist, actions that are racist. And it's hard, and it's really uncomfortable, but it's also really important. So with that, I think I'm going to kind of wind us up. But any last thoughts or questions? Thank you for being here tonight. Glad to have you.